truth. You know, we think, what is it to tell the truth? And I'm, you know, I'm not old enough, full disclosure, but there was this show once, this old 50s and 60s, this game show, right, called To Tell the Truth. And, you know, they put this panel together. And the idea was that, you know, the other few people would be up there, and they were allowed to distort things or lie or not say, but the one person who was chosen had to tell the truth. Now, they eventually rebooted the show, and they've come out with different versions of it, and then they try to bring it back a few years back. I don't even know if it's still on. I don't watch much TV. I don't certainly don't watch many game shows. But this idea of to tell the truth, because sometimes that's what we're confronted with as Christians. We know what the Bible says. We understand it may be our family, our friends, whoever it is. We know what's going on. We know what God is doing in their life. We understand what it is that this person needs. We understand how God is trying to get their attention. But what we have to confront is, in fact, are we willing to tell the truth? Do we want to sugarcoat it? Do we want to try to make it sound better? Or are we just willing to tell the truth regardless of what are in our mind the consequences might be? I want to start. We're going to look in Daniel chapter 5. We're going to start in verse 1. It says, King Belshazzar gave a banquet, a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles, and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem. And the kings and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand of the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. Let's pause there before we finish reading here. I want to set this up because what's happening here, so that we understand, this wasn't just, you know, King Belshazzar said, hey, let's go get the fine china and let's, you know, have a, you know, party. No, what happens is this king, and to be clear, historians in giving this some reference, this guy, Belshazzar, was actually, they call him King Belshazzar, but actually, he was actually second in line. His father is believed at this time to be out at battle and has already been captured. We'll get to that here in a second. And so he's actually on the throne in the moment, but actually, he was just careless. You know, he was kind of reckless. Like, the whole kingship thing was a matter of, you know, having fun. Wasn't something that he really took all that seriously. He was just, you know, I can just tell everybody what I want to do. And he took these sacred things. It says that Nebuchadnezzar went in and he took all these things. But Nebuchadnezzar, for all of his wickedness, for all of his evil, did not desecrate, did not use these fine things that they found in the Temple of Jerusalem in a disrespectful way. Well, this guy did, okay? And so it's not just that he was disrespecting their heritage, but he was literally thumbing his nose up at the idea of these people and their God. He knew the stories. He no doubt heard about many of the things we've talked about in the past few weeks about the different dreams. These things were passed down. He understood it. He just didn't care. He just was totally disrespectful and just flagrantly disrespectful of the things of God. And so we see this scene where this hand is writing on this plaster, this canvas. And he's terrified. And he brings in all of the wise men, all of these people who are into witchcraft and sorcery and can do spells and enchantments and all these things. And none of them can read it. But as we've seen the theme here, as we've gone through the book of Daniel, notice he didn't bring in Daniel. Seems like they always wait to bring in the man or the woman of God. They always wait till the last minute to bring them in, right? You know, kind of speaks to those who they know of God, but they really don't want to be confronted with it. Let's continue. It says the queen, and by the way, the queen, this is not actually his wife, the queen. This is his what is believed to be his grandmother, the queen. So it's the queen mother. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "May the king live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means." Now, this the queen mother here, she comes to him, and she says, "Hey, you know, I know of this guy." Notice she called him Daniel. And she says, the guy who the king called Belteshazzar, right? Like, isn't it amazing how when you're in trouble, all of a sudden you start seeing something mysterious happening? That those people that you didn't even bother to call in, the people that you didn't even bother to consult, suddenly now you're calling them by their Hebrew name. You know, suddenly you're giving them the respect. See, what we see here is very important for us as Christians to understand, because sometimes being a person that follows Christ, it can almost feel like you're slighted or disrespected. It can feel like maybe people aren't really paying attention to you. But in times of trouble, when it really, when they say when the rubber really meets the road, people know who to call. People know who to look for. People know who to say, "Hey, I need some prayer. I need some input. I need some advice." It's because even though it may not seem like people are paying attention, like we always say, somebody's always watching you, your reputation travels. You know, the people in the neighborhood, they may not even necessarily know exactly where you go to church, but they see the way that you live. They see the way that your family is, the way that your marriage is. They see how you behave. Your reputation travels. At this point, it's believed that Daniel was what you might describe in today's society as he was on the other side. He was kind of semi-retired, if you will, right? You know, so the idea of going to find him was because Daniel was kind of like, you know, "I don't want to be found. You know, I'm on my way out." But they went and they sought him out. Why? They went out and sought him out because they knew that if nobody else could do it, the man of God, there was this man of God who they could find that would be able to, as it says, explain it and tell them what the writing means. Our reputation carries far beyond those that we impact directly, and it always matters. Our reputation always matters. When you are a person who stands up for your faith, when you're a person who has conviction, when you're a person who is unwavering in your commitment to Christ, it always matters. And it may not seem like it matters to the people who are right in front of you. It may not seem like it matters in that moment, but at some point, later on, yes, it does. The baby agrees with me. Listen to the baby. It matters because here's the thing. Later on, as we see here with Daniel, long after Nebuchadnezzar was gone, and we're talking generations later. This is his grandson. When it says it's his father, but it's actually his grandson. Generations later, people will still know. They'll still remember your faith. They'll still remember your conviction. They will still remember that you stood for what was right. Your reputation carries. And your reputation requires that you tell the truth, that you stand for the truth. You know, when I think of truth as a kid, this first thing that came to mind, you know, I was told this story about Pinocchio. And, you know what I'm saying? It's like, hey, your nose is growing. You know, my mother would add to it, and it's not wider either. You know, it's like, tell the truth. You know, it's interesting because actually the story of Pinocchio, this is the Disney adaptation of it, but the original story was actually quite haunting if you go back and read. It's pretty ugly. Some of the little fairy tales they came up with back then, I'm thinking, oh, man, what children went through back then when they read through this stuff? But anyway, Disney adapted it, made it a little more children-friendly and palatable and everything. It wasn't quite as gruesome and mean and stuff like that. This guy, Jiminy Cricket, I used to like him. But we know the story of Pinocchio, and it teaches a lesson. This is actually when William was little. This was one of his favorite cartoons. I remember I got it on DVD, and then eventually I got the movie that we could play digitally, and he would watch it on his tablet. And I remember he asked, am I a real little boy? I'm like, yes, you're a real little boy, and you have to tell the truth, right? We expect our children to tell the truth. We teach our children to tell the truth. We enforce this idea. We encourage this idea of telling the truth. You know, when you see little kids and you think, man, you know what? You got nothing to be afraid of. You're just a little baby. You're just a kid. Be who you are. And sometimes it's not just telling the truth and giving an honest answer, but sometimes it's even living in the truth of who you are. Sometimes we want to hide and run away from the truth of who we are, who we're called to be. Who God expects us to be, we run from it. We don't want to deal with it because the truth would make us look like an outcast or an outsider. It would make us stand out in a way we don't want to stand out. And yet God still wants us to tell the truth, even when it seems like it's hard. Daniel was put in this situation. He didn't ask to be in this situation. He wasn't looking for any trouble. This man was minding his business. And yet he was called to come and tell this man some very harsh, very difficult truth. I want to look at this, continuing on in verse 22. It says, but you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines, drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. Many, many, tekel, parsin. Here's what those words mean. And before we go into what it means, understand that there's two different thoughts on this. One is that this was written in Hebrew and that the other wise men and the other, enchanters and different ones, didn't necessarily understand Hebrew, but the other was that they understood the words. They could read the words, and they could make sense of the words. Surely they were smart enough to know that, but they didn't understand how it applied to him. They didn't understand how it applied to his life. Very often, we can be thrust in that situation where everyone around is watching the same thing, but God put it on your heart. God has made it clear to you why it is that this person is dealing with this or going through this. And the reason why you're there is not necessarily to interpret and try to decipher the words, but sometimes you're chosen there to tell the truth and give the meaning. So he gives the meaning here. Here's what these words mean. Many, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. And Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Daniel wasn't just brought in there to give some, you know, like decipher this and you know, translate this. He was actually brought in to essentially read this man his rights. He says, you have not humbled yourself. You've been disrespectful. And as a result, you're going to pay a price. And the reason why God brought Daniel in is so that there could be no ambiguity, no confusion that this is from the Lord. I'm here to tell you this, and it's not going to be pleasant, Belshazzar. I'm here to tell you this, and you're not going to like it. And there's going to be some consequences. But this is a man who would eventually face the lion's den. This is a man who, you know, stared at death. His friends were dealing with the fiery furnace. And because he had no fear, because he was not concerned about popular opinion and, you know, it wasn't like a poll was taken to see whether or not this was actually a good thing for him to say this. He was only concerned about one thing, and that was telling the truth, being authentic in telling the truth. When you're confident that you are firmly in God's will, you can speak boldly and with no fear. As Christians, we have to really ask ourselves, do we live this way? Do we live this way when it's hard? And again, you know, I'm sure Daniel didn't have any particular connection with Belshazzar at this point. I'm sure there was no bond that they had. So it maybe you might say, well, it wasn't as tough. But when you think about it, the example applies to us in this way. Do we tell those who are close to us the truth? Now, granted, we don't just, you know, blurt out anything and, you know, just, and we're not to be insensitive with it. The Bible tells us we need to speak the truth in love. But are we willing to tell people the truth? Not just some random stranger or somebody out there. It's easy to look at people and think, you don't know who God is, or you don't worship God, or you don't have faith in God. I can see this through your life. But do we tell our brothers and sisters here the truth? Are we willing to be like Daniel in this way? To say, you know what, brother? You have to get better. Sister, you're not living by faith when you do this, when you act this way. You're not growing. Spiritually, you're in a place where you're actually hurting people. It's becoming difficult. The reason why your life is this way, the reason why this is going on, everybody sees it, but guess what? The reason why I'm your friend, because I'm willing to tell you the truth, that you have to repent. Do we treat truth that way? Do we have this attitude with the people that we say that we love? The people that we say we care about and that we're willing to pray with them, suffer with them, that we're willing to walk with them, labor with them? Do we tell each other the truth, even when it's ugly and when it's hard? You know, there's a saying, this is a, I don't know who came up with this. It says, brutal honesty is not about being cruel, rude, shocking, or harsh. That's not brutal honesty. It's just brutal. You know, like I said, you don't have to be insensitive. You know, you don't have to be mean about it. That's not what brutal honesty is about. It's hard. It can be difficult. It's not in our delivery. It's in the content and the context of what we're saying. Here's another one. The problem in today's society is that the truth is in short supply and people love soft lies more than hard truths. People don't really want the truth because ultimately people just don't want to get better. I had a conversation with a friend of mine several weeks back, and it was a very difficult conversation, and he got angry with me, and I actually still haven't heard from him. I won't say his name in case he's listening, but call me. And the thing is, we had to confront some real ugly. Some real ugly. And, you know, one of the things he told me was, he said, you know, you always give, you know, whenever I talk to you, you always give me input as though it's always going to be okay or everything is going to be fine. And I said, well, you know, there's enough people in the world without faith that are pessimistic, that are lying, that see things only from their perspective. There's enough people in the world that'll do that. I'm going to give you the truth, but I want you to understand that there's hope because you know who God is. You know, and at the end of the day, there were just some things that he wasn't ready to confront and change. But I knew that there was a consequence that would come with that. I knew that there would be some distance initially. I've known him for years. I knew that there would be a struggle. And I knew, frankly, in how the conversation evolved, it hurt me, some of the things he said. But I couldn't allow that to be a reason to not tell him the truth. Because ultimately, that's what I'm accountable for. That's what we're accountable for. You know, this one I found kind of funny. What smoke detectors warn you of. The truth about smoke detectors are, there's that little sliver up there that's a fire hazard. That means you're actually in danger. And the majority of that is actually just your abilities in the kitchen. You know, I was thinking about it. I've only experienced one actual fire in my life, like in, you know, my personal dwelling where I lived. And it was in the kitchen. It was rather minor. But ironically, it had to do with my ability to cook. Smoke alarm goes off all the time. I know nobody's around to hear it, but the smoke alarm goes off all the time, and it's never a real fire hazard. It's really just, I don't know how to cook, you know? And sometimes we don't want to confront even that amount of truth. Oh, there's got to be something wrong with the battery. Maybe we need to get, you know, I told my wife the last time it happened a couple months ago, I was like, I think we need new smoke detectors. She was like, okay, if that makes you feel better. But when I walked in the door, it was kind of like this, because there's smoke everywhere. You know, this is a book, and I haven't had the opportunity to read it yet. It's a guy, his name is Mark Jordan, Telling Truths in the Church, Scandal, Flesh, and Christian Speech. And he talks about in this book, and again, I haven't had the opportunity to read it yet. I've heard a lot about it. But he talks about how, specifically, he's talking about the scandals that were in the Catholic Church. And that nobody wants to deal with the root of why the scandals are happening. Everybody gets caught up in the entertainment side of it and the news side of it and, you know, the diocese up in Boston and how they had to pay out $300 million to settle all these court cases. But nobody wants to deal with the root cause and the root reason of why it is that you had all these scandals in the first place. Nobody wants to deal with the sexual deviancy that led to all of this perversion and all of this pedophilia and all of these molestations. And we look at the Catholic Church and, you know, they're an easy kind of target. because there's been so much in the news about them. But when we ask ourselves, why isn't the church growing? Forget the Catholic Church. Forget them. Why isn't the church, why isn't this congregation growing? Why are we ourselves not growing? Do we not know the answers? Is the truth not available to us? Is the handwriting, you know, to use the story we just read, is the handwriting not on the wall and we can't interpret it? Or do we not want to deal with the truth about how we, each individual person, how we are not confronting our own truth? That really we don't want to make the sacrifices. We don't want to make the commitments. We don't want to repent. We don't want to do the things that are necessary, because it's easier, that soft lie is, well, people just aren't really interested in God anymore. They're not really seeking God like they used to back when I was younger. People just have gone off in these weird theories and far off explanations of God, and they're not really seeking the truth anymore. Or the truth could be that a part of it lies directly with us and what we've been unwilling to do. We've been unwilling to invest our time and sacrifice our energy to make it so that we can help people find him. Making ourselves available, because that's what's really the truth. And we see here that it's the ugly truth, it's the harsh truth. We may not want to, you know, compare ourselves to other groups like the Catholic Church and say, oh, we're not involved in the scandal. We don't have a bunch of sex scandals, or nobody's laundering money or stealing. Or, you know, there was a story back in Cincinnati, and I know of this person, but they had a lot of scandals going on, this humongous church, thousands of members, and now they basically disbanded, and they're selling the church for $8 million. And everybody's like, well, why do you need $8 million? Like, how do you go bankrupt? And you have to understand how big this church was. But the reason why is because all the money was coming in, the preacher and the other leadership within the church were using the money that was coming in to pay off all these people that were involved in their scandals. And we look at that, and again, that's an easy target. That's easy to see. I know some of these people, and I'm even friends with certain people. But the fact is, when we think about the truths that are in the church, the truth about where we are, the condition of the Dover Church of Christ, are we willing to tell the harsh truths to ourselves about what we need to do and what we need to change? I'll continue here. We'll go back a little bit in Daniel chapter 4, because we're going to look at what he has to say about another dream. Starting in verse 19, it says, then Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you. Belteshazzar answered, my lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. The tree you saw, which grew large and strong, with its top touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves and abundant fruit, providing food for all, giving shelter to the wild animals, and having nesting places in its branches for the birds. Your majesty, you are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to distant parts of the earth. He continues, your majesty saw a holy one, a messenger, coming down from heaven and saying, cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump bound with iron and bronze in the grass of the field. While its roots remain in the ground, let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live with the wild animals until seven times pass by for him. This is the interpretation, your majesty, and this is the decree the Most High has issued against my lord, the king. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals, You will eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with his roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, your majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue. Now, he's talking to, and I tell you, we'll come back to this, I told you this last week, he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar here, and what he's saying is, as great as you've become, and as powerful and influential and mighty, you know, I said, you know, the thing that made Nebuchadnezzar so such a standout amongst all the other kings that we read about is his ability to grow and prosper and expand the kingdom. But Daniel had to give him some humility. He had to give him a little humble pie. He had to bring him back down and point out to him that for as great as you are, you too are still going to be cut down. You're going to have to be cut down until you acknowledge who God is, until you put your faith in the right place. And sometimes it's important that we read this in Daniel chapter 4 where we see what Daniel said. It says he trembled. He was nervous at the idea. He was troubled not because he didn't understand what the dream meant. He understood it as soon as he heard it. But he was terrified at the idea that I'm going to have to tell this man something that he really doesn't want to hear. What's that saying? Feel the fear and do it anyway. Daniel had to feel the fear and do it anyway. The same thing applies to us. Very often, God puts us in the place where we are. He's given us that job. He's given us that house in that neighborhood. He's got us where it's like, I don't know why it is that I seem to always be matched up with this person. I don't understand why it is I'm so close to this person. We get along so well. We're such great friends. We live on the same floor or you know, we just, you know, our kids go to the same school. And we wonder why it is that God puts us in that place. And very often he puts us in that place because he's counting on you to be the vessel that gets used to tell the truth, to tell your son or your daughter the truth, to tell your mother or your uncle or your best friend or your son's teacher or your neighbor next door. The reason why you're there is to tell the truth. And it's the harsh truth, and it's a painful truth. And it's a truth that they may not like, but ultimately, it may very well save them. And that's why God has put you there. A willingness to tell hard, inconvenient truth brings even proud men to acknowledge God. And it's not hard to identify when we see people who don't acknowledge God, but for us, when it's not hard, the difficulty is, are we willing to tell them that, because we're more interested in the outcome of them ultimately repenting, ultimately coming to God, and we care more about that than we care about whatever consequences or repercussions that we may end up having to deal with. A few questions before we end up here. Do I cower back or sugarcoat the truth for fear of other people's reactions? Is my character one of a conflict avoider? You know, I use that term conflict avoider because, you know, oftentimes we'll sugarcoat the truth and we massage the truth and we come up with ways to dull it or water it down. And it's not because that person can't handle it. It's not even because they may not be expecting it. It's because ultimately we're afraid of what their reaction is going to be towards us. Do we understand how important the truth is? And that when we avoid conflict in the name of, well, I didn't want to be harsh, or I didn't want to hurt their feelings, or I didn't want them to reject me, that ultimately we're giving them that those soft lies because we're not telling them the full truth. We're not telling them the real answer. We're not actually doing what God sent us to do in that situation. Do we sugarcoat the truth? Number two, when dealing with difficult people or relationships, do I trust God to protect me in the situation more than I trust my words? Very often we can get so caught up on our words and making sure that we say it just the right way. And I raise my hand, guilty as charged. This was a really big difficulty for me for so many years where I wanted to make sure that it came out perfect and I wanted to make sure my words were said right and understood. And I remember, I think I told you guys about this, but I remember one of my friends, Dusty, he told me, he said, they heard you. They heard exactly what you said. It doesn't matter how you say it or how you fix it or how you massage it in word placement in a sentence. The truth is what it is. They know exactly what you're saying. But very often, we trust our words more than we trust the truth that we were sent out to deliver. You know, I think, you know, I use the example of a police officer handing out an indictment. And, you know, you think about it, does it really matter if, you know, sheriff walks up and puts an eviction notice on your door with a smile on his face or not? You know, how happy was the sheriff when he showed up and he nailed that eviction on your door? When the cop put you in cuffs and put you in the back of the car, did it really matter how happy he was in that moment, how pleasant he was, especially when you know you're about to do some real time? Very often we get so caught up on how we deliver and making sure that we sound right instead of making sure that the truth in its entirety is told. Are we willing to deal with the truth, and do we trust God to protect us as we bring the truth forward? What person in my life challenges my boldness of conviction the most? Have I conceded my powerlessness in the relationship? And do I need to reevaluate my reason for being in it with them? You know, I ask this question because the idea of conceding, that concession of powerlessness, that idea that, you know what, I know what the truth is. I know a God who can save. See, what we see with Belshazzar's grandmother is that she didn't just say, well, you know what? No, there's nothing I can do about the situation. The king is he's a maniac. He's disrespectful. He shows no regard for anything. And so there's nothing that I can say to him. She didn't concede to that. God used her and said, I know somebody who can fix this for you. Those of us who are Christians, we know somebody who can fix it. We doubt that people will listen. We have conceded this idea that me bringing the truth is not enough. And therefore, we don't open our mouths. We don't share the truth. And then we wonder why things don't change. We wonder why things don't get better, why they get worse. We need to really consider, why do I have this relationship with this person who is not living for him? If not for the fact that God wants you there to tell them the truth. God wants you to speak of him and his goodness and his faith. That's why you spend so much time with them. That's why you're related to them. That's why you work with them. That's why you're their neighbor, so that you can talk and you can open up. We cannot concede that people are not going to listen because of how much sin they have in their life or how much they seem on the outset to be unwilling to change. We cannot concede that. We can't concede that if we're truly going to live out our purpose as Christians. And finally, is Jesus Lord of my life, including my tongue and how, when, and why I speak to others? You know that term about speaking truth to power? The whole book of Daniel was one big book on and writing. Oh my goodness, what happened? Somebody must have got to the microphone. Anyway, The whole book of Daniel is one big book that talks about speaking truth to power, being unafraid to tell people the harsh and difficult truth. If Daniel had no other purpose in his life, his purpose was he was taken, plucked out of his comfort zone, plucked out of his culture, plucked out of his home. And he spent 70 years. And all those 70 years, what did he do? King after king after king. Person in power, person of influence, person who was considered important, he spoke the truth to each and every one of them. He understood that that was his reason for being there. That was the purpose. He was given those dreams. He was given the ability to interpret those dreams. He was given that particular gift so that he could speak truth to power. Very often we have the gift and the ability to do certain things, but we fail to recognize that the reason why you have that gift is because it puts you in proximity. It puts you in relationship with people who need to hear the truth. But are we bold enough? Is our faith strong enough that we will do it? Do you know what it is to have that faith? Are you someone who needs that type of faith? You recognize the need for God in your life. You recognize it, but you have yet to give your life to God. And allow him to use you in the way that he used Daniel. Allow him to use you in such a way that you are able to not only know God for yourself, but also be able to help others know what it means to have faith in the one true God. Have you ever made that commitment? If you haven't, then as a church, we want to help you. We want to help you grow in that way. We want to help you understand what it means to have a real relationship with God. So that it's not just words on a paper that you read in a book called the Holy Bible, but that you understand how it is that you apply this to yourself, what it means to really, truly be a follower of Christ. If this is a commitment that you haven't made, if you need the prayers of the church, if you need help to be able to strengthen your faith in such a way that you can grow, so that you can be bold, so that you can be willing to speak the truth in any circumstance, in any situation, without fear of consequences. Please come forward as we stand and sing our song of invitation.